We're going to turn to Acts chapter 25 and verse 13. We're a wee bit late starting this evening. Thought I'd come to the Quakers by mistake. So we might be a wee bit late finishing. Acts chapter 25 verse 13. And after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, saying, There is a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him, to whom I answered, It is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Therefore, when they were come hither without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom, when the accusers stood up, they brought none accusation, as such things as I supposed, but had certain questions against him of their own superstition, and of one Jesus, which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him, whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved unto the hearing of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said unto Festus, I would also hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, thou shalt hear him. And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, and was entered into the place of hearing with the chief captains and principal men of the city at Festus' commandment, Paul was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found out that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord. Wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and specifically before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write. For it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Amen. Well, we need to do some preparatory work in order to look at Acts chapter 26. Where there is some very, very important content that we need to learn. So what we've got to do tonight is a little bit of history and background so that whenever we come to Acts 26 in a few weeks' time, we will understand what's happening. And last week, when we finished our last study, Paul had appealed to Caesar, hadn't he? He said in verse 11, I appeal unto Caesar. Verse 12, then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar thou shalt go. So Paul is going to go to Caesar. And now he's been standing in another Roman court. He's been standing before Festus, the new Roman procurator. He should have been set free. He should have been acquitted right there and then. But Festus, as we saw last time, put his political ambitions before actual justice. So he wanted to make a good impression back in Rome. Because the Jews were the main source of discontent, he wanted to sweeten them. And so he had suggested, here's a great idea. We'll not try you here in Caesarea, the Roman capital of Judea. We'll let you go back to Jerusalem. And when you go back to Jerusalem, I will sit in judgment on you, but you'll be in Jerusalem, and that will please the Jews. Now, as we saw last week, the likelihood of Paul actually reaching Jerusalem alive was slim. And perhaps Festus was hatching a plot in his mind. Perhaps he was saying to himself, well, sure, what's one life compared with the whole region up in turmoil? Want to keep these Jews, they're being troublesome. I want to try and appease them. Want to try and make a good impression back in Rome. If one man has to die for to keep the peace of the entire nation, well, sure, what is it? For the greater good, isn't it? And so, here Paul, sensing what's happening, decides that he's going to appeal to a higher court, to Caesar. If he went to Jerusalem, he is basically a dead man walking. And that leaves Festus with a problem. And that's where this passage comes in. We've got the problem, and we've got the prince, and we've got a parade. We like parades. And we've got a preamble. So we've got them all in P's tonight, which makes it a wee bit easier to understand. So in verse 27, we have the problem. Let's see it. In verse 27, right at the very end of the reading, it seemed to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. See, Roman law was very strict. One of the things I've been mentioning, right as we've gone through the whole book of Acts, is about the Lex Romana. It was a law that was laid down. And under certain circumstances, a man who was accused of a crime has a right of appeal. A right of appeal that goes right to the very top of the empire, right to the supreme court of the day, to Caesar himself. Now, the problem is, Caesar, when Paul is appealing to him, the man he's appealing to is Nero. And who is Nero? Well, Nero is a degenerate, sexually depraved, immoral, worthless waster. Have I described him adequately? Nero couldn't care less about sitting on the bench and judging appeal cases from remote parts of the empire. Nero wanted to fiddle while Rome burned, so they say. Nero just wanted to enjoy himself. He didn't want to be bothered with all the administration of justice. He would let one of the city fathers do that on his behalf. But whether Nero would judge Paul's case or an underling, it didn't matter, because the Lex Romana, the law of Rome, was the same for everybody. And the law dictated that any lesser magistrate, like Festus, would have to make sure that an appellant to the court at Rome had substantial charges placed against him. You don't send someone to Caesar for shoplifting. You punish them there and then. And those charges, those substantial charges, had to be properly documented. A file had to be written up. It had to be personally submitted by the procurator himself. Festus would have to write that report. He would consult all the sources. He would have read the letter from Lysias, the commander at Jerusalem, who had brought Paul down to Caesarea in the first place. He would read the minutes from the trial under Felix. He would include the notes from his own court proceedings. He would include the accusations of the Jews. But when he had it all written out and laid out before him in report style, it didn't add up. There's a problem. And the problem is found right here in this chapter, in verse 20, in chapter 25 and verse 10. I want you to look at it with me. Paul said, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat. This is Paul placing himself under Roman law. Where I ought to be judged, to the Jews I have done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. See, there's the point. Festus, looking at his report, knew fine rightly, Paul has done nothing wrong under Roman law. And if Festus sends a man to Caesar for a trivial case, a man who's blatantly innocent, a man who should literally be set free there and then, except that it would cause an awful upheaval among the Jews, a man who has no charges to answer, he's in danger of wasting the Supreme Court's time. And what's he going to write about anyway? The whole matter is just about nothing other than Jewish religion. And Festus knows absolutely nothing about Jewish religion. It's a major headache. It's a problem. A report to write. A report that doesn't add up. And a report he doesn't understand the legal technicalities of. What's he going to do? Suddenly, all Festus's problems seem to dissolve. Unexpectedly, perhaps, a solution offers itself in the shape of one Herod Agrippa II, the problem, and the prince, verse 13. And after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came on to Caesarea to salute Festus. There's a king. King Herod Agrippa II. I mean, King Herod Agrippa II was the ruler of a tiny little piece of Palestine round Galilee. It would hardly be bigger than a city. He was the seventh and he was the last of the Herods, the Herodian dynasty. It had begun with his great-grandfather, Herod the Great, the man who slaughtered the children at the time of the birth of Christ. And Agrippa's own father, Herod Agrippa I, was the man who had locked up Peter at Jerusalem in Acts chapter 12. Now, none of these Herods are actually kings. We call them King Herod because they called themselves kings. They were actually just Jewish aristocrats. And they held their titles only because Rome allowed them to hold them. So Herod the Great had been appointed as the ruler of Judea by Mark Antony. And that title, he had then been given a minor kingdom by Claudius. He'd been promoted to a larger, had been promoted to a larger province by Nero. He was living and reigning at Caesarea Philippi, and he later renamed that Neronius in honor of Nero. So this Herod, Herod Agrippa II, was in his own mind a king. In our terms, he would be a sort of a super mayor, like the man that's the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan. He might think of himself as a king too, but he's not, it's just in his own head. So this man, Herod Agrippa, King Herod, in order to retain his title and his privileges and his dictatorship over this tiny little piece of land, needs to keep Rome happy. And of course, what happened last week whenever we were reading the first little installment about Festus? Festus has just arrived from Rome. He's replaced Felix. He's a new governor. And Agrippa needs to go and grovel to him. And as soon as possible, he makes his way up to Caesarea. And with him comes someone called Bernice. Look at verse 13 again. Mark it there. After certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came onto Caesarea. It doesn't say Queen Bernice. Now, Bernice is a nasty piece of work. Bernice is the Greek form of her name. The Romans called her Veronica. She was Agrippa's sister, and she was totally and utterly devoid of any moral capabilities whatsoever. Her father, who was also Herod's father, Herod Agrippa I, had married her off to an uncle just as soon as she was of marriageable age. The marriage didn't last. She came back home and she was living with her brother. Let me put it like this. They were living together as man and wife. So she was engaged in an incestuous relationship. She left him for a while and married someone else and then came back to him and then became the mistress of Titus, the man who later sacked Rome and became emperor in AD 79. And he refused to marry her. What I'm trying to get at here, and one of the things that we've learned as we have been looking at this Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire coming, it's in its heyday. It's going to last for another 200 or 300 years after this. But have you noticed, as we've looked at life in the Roman Empire, the extreme immorality and decadence of society? I want to contrast two things. Because in Rome, the law of the land, the Lex Romana, is still being adhered to. It's still intact. The supreme authority was no longer interested in administering it, but it's still there. The army is still in charge. The peace is still being maintained. But the moral fibre of Roman society is absolutely rotten. Right to the very core. The great and the good were by no means good. They were utterly degenerate and depraved in every sense. And the end of that society would soon come. Isn't it strange that great cultures with great traditions and great laws, great empires, sooner or later, they become decadent. Sooner or later, they become immoral. Sooner or later, their rulers lose their moral compass and they drift. Step back and look at our society. How would you describe a society like ours, a society that now murders its own children in the womb, like the Romans did. The Romans did it on the hillsides. A society that doesn't know the difference between men and women. You know, when the leader of the opposition is asked, does he know what a woman is? Finds it hard to answer. A society that markets sexuality for profit. A society that pretends that a family can be two men or two women. A society where just last week a college swimming competition, a national competition in the United States of America for women was won by a man who thinks he's a woman. A society that has rejected its roots and despised its history. and forsaken its God cannot last. Is our Western society, our so-called civilization, going to go the way of the Roman Empire if the Lord hasn't returned before that day? Well, we must hope that that's what happens, that the Lord will return before the civilization as we know it ends, and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren are enslaved in whatever evil system replaces our so-called Western democracy. I digress. Let's get back to the text. There was one thing that Herod was good at. These are two immoral people, Herod and Agrippa, Agrippa and Bernice. But there was one thing that Herod Agrippa was good at. He knew the Jews. His family had dealt with the Jews for generation after generation. He was actually a Jew himself. And the Romans had appointed him as a Jew, as the nominator of the Jewish high priests. He could appoint the priests. He could remove them. He had a palace in Jerusalem near to the temple, and yet he was totally immoral, and yet he was a Jew. He was just like the immoral Jewish leaders of the Old Testament. And Festus saw this as his opportunity. He would pick Agrippa's brain. He would get some ideas to write in his report to the Supreme Court at Rome. And from verse 14 down to 21, Festus gives Agrippa a summary of the case as he understands it. Look at your Bible. He's saying to them, there's a man that the Jews want dead. There is a certain man. There is a certain man, verse 14, left in bonds by Felix. There's a man, actually the word that the Jews want dead, there's a certain man left in bonds about whom, when I was in Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. Do you see that very carefully? They didn't want fair justice. They actually just simply wanted him accused. They wanted an automatic declaration of guilt, a condemnation. The Greek here is katadike, a sentence of condemnation. But Roman law prohibits such a thing. Verse 16, to whom I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before a trial. And then the charges won't stick in Rome anyway. Look at verse 18. Against whom, when the accusers stood up, they brought none accusation of such things as I supposed, but had certain questions against him of their own superstition. Now, the word superstition there, the AV, probably is not a good translation of the word. It's unlikely that such an accomplished diplomat as Festus would offend Agrippa by referring to his sincerely held beliefs as superstition. It's simply a form of religious belief. But the gospel is the real issue here. And Festus gets to it. He says it was about one Jesus who was dead, according to Festus, but which he, per se, Paul was preaching to be alive, verse 19, had certain questions against him of their own superstition and of one Jesus which was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. Now Agrippa is only too willing to help, verse 22. And Agrippa said unto Festus, I would also hear the man myself. And Festus replied, tomorrow, said he, thou shalt hear him. All right, so we've got, first of all, the problem. And then the answer to the problem is the prince. And then we've got the parade in verse 23. So on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice with great pomp, and was entered into the place of hearing with the chief captains and principal men of the city. At Festus' commandment, Paul was brought forth. Now, there's an awful lot in that verse. I want you to use your imagination as you read that text. Think of it. Think of what this occasion would be like. Because, you see, the Romans loved pomp and ceremony. And they did it really, really well. The word here in verse 23 that says Bernice, Agrippa has come and Bernice with great pomp. The Greek word there is a word you will know. It's the word fantasia. And if you know what fantasia is, it's a display. It's a pomp. It's a parade. It's a fantastic visual representation of the greatness of Rome. So you have to think about it and think what that fantasia would be, what it would be like. There's this great big judgment hall in Caesarea, and Festus walks in and everyone bows to him, and he goes and he sits on the judgment seat, and he's dressed in the scarlet robes of state. And around him, the verse tells us, are his military commanders, all the great officers of the Roman army. And then there's the chief men of the city, all the business class, they're arraigned down the side. All the politicians are there. They're all surrounding this great hall. And then there's the phalanx, the guard. The Roman soldiers are there, and they're standing tightly packed close together, demonstrating the political power of Rome. And then there's a clarion call. A trumpet sounds, and the whole assembly stands, and into the midst of them comes the king, King Agrippa, in his purple robe and Bernice by his side. And they would parade up to the judgment seat. Festus will stand and he'll walk forward and he'll welcome them. And the whole spectacle speaks about position and power and the imperial rule of Rome. Can you think about it in your mind? Can you see the might and the majesty that's portrayed in this verse? And then the assembly is seated, all except the soldiers. And Festus commands that the prisoner be brought. Now contrast this great pomp of Rome with the man who is now brought in to that scene, Paul the Apostle. And there's only one secular, non-biblical description of Paul, and it comes from a man called Onesiphorus. And Onesiphorus sees Paul as a man small of stature, with a bald head and crooked legs, a good state of body, with eyebrows meeting, and a hooked nose, full of friendliness. And he's in chains. And into this great, majestic assembly comes this wee man, chained, bent over, bowed. What a contrast. And the only reason I'm trying to get you to picture that contrast in your mind is because one day in this society in which we live, any one of us might find ourselves in a similar situation. It might be in a courtroom. It might be before a judge with a gown and a wig and an aura of authority. A man with the legal right to condemn you to years in a prison. And Paul's in that situation. And later on, he would write to a young pastor who also may well find himself in a similar situation. And he says to him, preach the word. Be instant in season and out of season. This is an out of season time. As we will see when we meet together again. In the midst of that intimidating assembly, Paul will faithfully preach the word. Do you know what was said of Mary, Queen of Scots? That she once said, I would rather face the armies of England and face the prayers of John Knox. For Knox had stood before her and fearlessly preached God's word. And finally, we have the preamble, verse 24 to verse 26. And I'm calling it a preamble because Festus is simply summing up the charges to the court before the proceedings begin. In verse 24, Festus says, King Agrippa, and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man, about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord. Wherefore I have brought him before you, and specifically before thee, O King Agrippa. So there's where we are. Paul's standing now. And Festus has admitted that he has nothing to write. I don't know what to say about this man. I'm hoping you can help me out, Agrippa. And next time, we'll see what Paul says. What Agrippa says to Paul and what Paul says to him. There's just one wee thing we need to clear up before we finish, just in case it causes some confusion. In verse 25 and earlier in the chapter, in verse 21... Festus refers to Caesar in the name of, using the name Augustus. Now, that's not a chronological error. Caesar Augustus was also known as Octavian, and he was the first Roman emperor ruling from 27 BC until his death in AD 14. So he was around about when Jesus was born. This meeting of Festus and Agrippa is 40 years later, long after Augustus had died. Nero was on the throne at Rome. The Greek word here is the word Sebastos, from which we get the name Sebastian. It literally means venerable. It's like us saying, Your Majesty, if you do that sort of thing when the Queen comes, or My Lord to a judge or whatever. And it's just a demonstration here of how Luke is always carefully, historically accurate. These underlings of the Roman state would always have referred to Caesar as being His Majesty, Augustus. So the scene is set for next time. And Paul has been brought before King Agrippa. Festus needs to write this report. Agrippa is conversant with the background information. He has the theological insights that Festus thinks that he needs, and the prisoner is set before him. So what will Paul say, and how will he say it? See you next time.